Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we speak with Paul Meyer, a former colleague in the Foreign Service and a global expert on arms control issues. Paul is a fellow in international security and adjunct professor of international studies at Simon Fraser University and a senior advisor to ICT for Peace. A former Canadian ambassador for disarmament, he is currently the chair of the Canadian Pugwash Group. Paul has written a paper, Overcoming the NPT's Institutional Deficit, a Canadian saga, in the most recent edition of the International Journal. The link to the site is on our webpage. In it, Paul writes that as we go into a new review process of the NPT, the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, we need to act. Paul writes that ever since the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was indefinitely extended in 1995, Canada has promoted the concept of, quote, permanence with accountability, unquote. Canada led on an ambitious initiative to enhance accountability through a package of reform measures, including establishing annual meetings of state parties, that's like nations, creating a standing body of past, present, and future chairs, and providing for the convening of extraordinary meetings. Launched prior to the failed 2005 review conference, the effort was sustained for a decade. These ideas attracted support, but also opposition. As Paul writes, it's a cautionary tale in the dynamics of multilateral diplomacy in the nuclear realm and on the weaknesses in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty process that continues to threaten the authority of the treaty. Some background for listeners. It's been 75 years since the United States dropped atomic bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and 50 years since the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, designed to limit the spread of nuclear weapons, went into force. Now arms control agreements are collapsing, the deployment of new types of weapons is changing, strategic calculations and geopolitical tensions heighten the risk that a conventional conflict could escalate. The nuclear arms race was central to U.S.-Soviet competition during the Cold War, and arms control was carefully negotiated between Washington and Moscow. But then the Soviet Union collapsed. President George W. Bush put forward an aggressive policy to stop proliferation and cut U.S. stockpiles in half, but by the time he left office, President Barack Obama began his term with an ambitious plan to abolish nuclear arms altogether. For his part, President Trump is reinvesting in America's nuclear arsenal. So, Paul, while we are currently transfixed by the threat of microbes rather than missiles, nuclear weapons and their proliferation still constitute an existential threat. It's the one thing that kept U.S. presidents, or at least until Donald Trump, up at night. Let's start with some basics. How many nations have the bomb, and are they all parties to the NPT? Paul?
Yeah, thanks, Colin. Well, there are five so-called nuclear weapon states that are signatories to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and those are the United States, Russia, China, France, and the U.K. In addition, there are four states possessing nuclear weapons outside the treaty. That's India, Pakistan, North Korea, and Israel, though the last Israel has neither confirmed nor denied its possession of nuclear weapons. So that's the lineup.
So the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, and as you say, India, Pakistan, North Korea, and Israel. And are they all parties to the NPT?
No, the first five I mentioned are. The other four are outside the treaty, i.e. they've never signed on that treaty and therefore are not bound by it.
And that is a problem. And any sign that they would join?
Well, it seems remote. You're right. The universality of the treaty is a goal that is affirmed, but clearly one of the overriding problems moving towards nuclear disarmament is that you have five of these nuclear weapon states that have a legal commitment to disarm, but you have as well four that have rejected being bound by that commitment.
Now, what about the rest of the world? In countries like Canada, I presume we're parties to the NPT, aren't we?
Yeah, it's among the most widely supported multilateral treaty in existence. There's 190 states parties to the treaty. It codifies what has been often called a grand bargain with three parts to it. The first is that the nuclear weapon states commit to nuclear disarmament. The second is that the non-nuclear weapon states promise never to acquire nuclear weapons or develop them. And the third is that all of the parties are supposed to support the peaceful uses of nuclear energy, nuclear power.
And that's how it works. Now, you know, there's been a fair bit of attention the last couple of years, as you well know, Paul, around North Korea. Even Donald Trump has been going to see Kim Jong-un and saying, all right, disarm. But is North Korea the only sort of state that is seen as the threat in terms of nuclear proliferation, or are there other countries?
No, I think, unfortunately, the security situation is very fluid at the moment, and countries will make their own calculations about whether to remain within the treaty or to decide, as the treaty permits, for a withdrawal. And the Middle East has traditionally been one of the hotspots for potential future proliferation, you know, with countries like Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, all at different times being seen as candidates for that. And East Asia, Northeast Asia, remains also a problematic region, given how North Korea may evolve, and indeed China's own actions. One could see pressure building in countries like Japan and South Korea, Taiwan, to acquire nuclear weapons. You know, this technology is not as sophisticated as it once was, and it's really within the purview of any country with a modicum of industrial ability and scientific and technological capacity to develop nuclear weapons if they so desire. So it's important not to be complacent and assume that the relatively great success of the NPT in holding the line on proliferation is necessarily going to continue in the future.
So let's just go back for a sec. I know you briefly described it, but just what are the obligations of the 190 nations that are members of the NPT? What is it they actually have undertaken to do and not to do?
Well, as I tried to describe, this tripartite bargain is the heart of it. So the five nuclear weapon states party to the treaty commit to nuclear disarmament, and the remaining 186 states promise never to acquire, develop nuclear weapons. And then there's this common commitment to be supportive of peaceful uses of nuclear energy. So those are the essential commitments of the states parties to the treaty.
And you mentioned both the Middle East, so countries like Saudi Arabia, and you specifically spoke about Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. Are they all parties to the NPT?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay. In your paper, you call the NPT the poor cousin of multilateral agreements. Why are they the poor cousin?
Well, Colin, the NPT as an early multilateral agreement lacked a lot of the institutional support elements that have become the norm for subsequent multilateral agreements. So, for instance, outside of the once-in-five-year review conferences are not fully empowered decision-making meetings of the states' parties. In contrast, most agreements now provide for an annual or biannual conference of states' parties that allow them on a regular basis to meet together and take decisions as necessary. There's also an all-dedicated secretariat to support the treaty comprehensively. There's an all-standing bureau. There's an all-provision for convening an emergency meeting of the states' parties, which was particularly put into relief back in 2003 when North Korea gave notice of its intention to withdraw from the treaty, which obviously impacts the security of all the other states' parties. But there was no provision to gather the NPT states together to react to this development. So all these elements have led to what is seen as an institutional deficit regarding the NPT, which Canada and some like-minded states try to overcome, as I describe in my article, through a series of reform ideas, some of which that you briefly outlined in the introduction.
Let me park the NPT for a sec. There are other fora that discuss disarmament, including the Conference on Disarmament that meets in Geneva that you would have known as ambassador charged with the UN with negotiating multilateral arms control. But its effectiveness has often been criticized by Canada. You were there. Why is that?
Well, it's essentially because of a very extreme interpretation of the consensus principle for decision-making that the 65 members of the Conference on Disarmament have adopted, whereby null decision, be it substantive or procedural, can be made unless all 65 members agree to it. So this means, in effect, that any one member has a veto over decisions of the conference. And as a result of that, and competing perspectives on security priorities, the conference has been in a moribund state for over 20 years now. Literally, since 1998, has not been able to agree on a program of work. So there's been no negotiation on any of the seven items of the CD's standing agenda. And I think including a fissile material cutoff treaty, which is a long-standing priority for the NPT community. I mean, essentially, it would ban the production of fissile material, the necessary ingredient for making nuclear weapons. But that treaty hasn't seen even an initial day of negotiation, in part because it has been assigned to the Conference on Disarmament, which has amounted to a kiss of death for this treaty. So ironically, even though Canada has been very active on this file, it too continues to espouse the position that the only form to negotiate such a treaty would be in the Conference on Disarmament. The reality is that the only successful arms control, multilateral arms control agreements to have been negotiated in the last decade have been through authorization by the UN General Assembly. And as you know well, the General Assembly works by majority voting and not through consensus. And as a result, therefore, it's been able to produce agreements like the Arms Trade Treaty and the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which would not have been possible if countries had insisted only on a CD venue for the negotiation.
Paul, remind me, President Obama, who was really this was something that he cared a lot about, and I think he initiated a couple of conferences, which were then subsequently held, I think, if I recall, every couple of years, I think the Hague and Seoul. What happened to that process?
Yeah, that was the so-called Nuclear Security Summit process. And frankly, I thought it was a waste of the convening authority of the United States. You know, yes, there are issues relating to the security of fissile materials, et cetera, which are worthy of cooperation and work. But to have left out from the agenda of those meetings the question of nuclear weapons and the actions or inactions by states to reduce the threat that those weapons provide, I think was a real failing of the Security Summit, the series of three meetings that President Obama was able to, in a sense, convene with the authority of the United States. And frankly, with his departure, even that sort of exercise in international cooperation has petered out.
Paul, your paper, which again, I heartily recommend to our listeners, you make the point that personalities at these sessions really make a difference, not always for the good. Can you explain a bit what you mean by that?
Well, Colin, as you know, I tend to stress to my students, you know, diplomacy, you know, times it's conceived of as international systems, organizations, procedures, but at its heart, it relies on interpersonal relations. And so individuals and personalities can and do play a significant role in whether any sort of diplomatic process is going to succeed or fail. And as I illustrated in that article, you know, there were some examples in terms of the fate of this Canadian initiative in terms of reform of the NPT procedures, where that was borne out.
All right, let's go into a bit of, as you say, the Canadian proposal, of which you would have been a part of, because some of this took place when you were there and throughout the career. You talk about, and you set out in the paper, some options to revise progress on arms control. Do you want to talk a bit about those proposals and what role you see for Canada in promoting, I guess, greater cooperation that until now has been very difficult to achieve, as you point out, unless you work through the UN, where it's a majority vote as opposed to the consensus that's required in some of the other forum.
Yeah, well, I think that there's a range of actions that could be taken to support cooperative security outcomes, and indeed to remove the risks associated with these standing nuclear arsenals. One is, as I've already noted, is to look to starting some of these neglected negotiations via resolutions in the UN General Assembly, so that a few handful of countries that want to be spoilers aren't able to prevent a negotiation getting underway. And there's also the need to speak up and lobby those, particularly the allies, but not only the allies possessing nuclear weapons, to take steps to reduce risks. Clearly, one of the areas that we need to hear more advocacy from the part of non-nuclear weapon states regarding the nuclear weapon states is their responsibilities under the NPT. You know, and that means speaking out in favor, for instance, of maintaining strategic reduction agreements between Russia and the United States. The extension of the New START is a specific point. It would have been helpful to have urged greater efforts to find a solution to the compliance dispute over the INF treaty that led to its demise. It would be helpful to again take actions to preserve the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which represented, I think, a very important example of how multilateral diplomacy can be used to address longstanding nuclear proliferation concerns. There's also steps to press for the so-called de-alerting. People may not be aware that out of these 14,000 nuclear weapons currently in the possession, the U.S. and Russia maintain 1,000 or more of them on so-called high alerts. And these countries have not rejected launch-on-warning strategies, which conceivably could have those missiles launched in a matter of minutes. And with all the potential for human or technical error in early warning systems, etc., you know, this remains, I think, an unacceptable risk for the international community. So there are lots of ways with that concerned states can act at this time. And I don't know about you, Colin, but I frankly find, I mean, the current environment very disquieting and indeed frightening at some extent. And when you look at who are the leaders currently that have their finger on the proverbial nuclear weapon button, you have leaders like Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, President Xi, Kim Jong-un, Prime Minister Modi. So I don't know, these don't exactly instill a high level of reassurance that there would be great sobriety and caution in approaching issues in a context of an escalating crisis somewhere.
No, and Paul, that's exactly why we're doing this podcast, because I think this is an important issue. And that's why I think your paper deserves a broader readership and listenership. You know, when we talked about the spoilers, I presume you're talking about some of the actors you just named.
Yes, I think there's resistance in some quarters, but there's a powerful interest, I would hope, would motivate states to engage on this. I don't know if you're aware, but last year at the initiative of the Swedish foreign minister, there was a group of 16 states, Canada included, that met last summer in Stockholm, and a follow-up meeting of this same ministerial group in Berlin under the auspices of the German foreign minister. And by taking that kind of action at the foreign minister level, it was a sign of high-level political concern about the deteriorating international security situation, and particularly that regarding the strain on the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. I regret that neither Minister Freeland nor Minister Champagne found it possible to attend personally those ministerial sessions, but we were represented. And this, I think, represents the kind of political energy and diplomatic engagement that we need to see going forward. This was partly instigated by the NPT Review Conference, which was due to get underway next week in New York. And because of the COVID-19 situation, it has been postponed to a time not later than next April. But it's important that we seize this interim period, if you will, for, I think, particularly the non-nuclear weapon states to consort and to use their influence to try to ensure that we have some substantial outcomes that will help reinforce the authority of this cornerstone treaty when the parties can meet again.
Paul, civil society used to play a big role in disarmament. You know, certainly when I grew up as a kid and you as a kid, there were the great marches were usually around disarmament, the CND and things. You're now leading the Canadian Pugwash group. Tell us a bit about that and also offer, you know, it's in some ways it struck me that the where it used to be around disarmament and nuclear weapons, the kind of civic movement has moved towards climate. They're not necessarily opposed to one another, but the energy that used to be devoted to disarmament seems to have shifted to climate. I don't know whether that's fair and what you think of that, but it sort of comes back.
I think you're right, and indeed one of the objectives of civil society groups that are concerned with nuclear disarmament is to find a way to impress upon those, particularly younger generations that are concerned with climate change, that if you had even a modest use of nuclear weapons, the effects on the stratosphere would result in a nuclear winter type phenomenon that could have a devastating impact in terms of food security going forward. Some estimates have said that an exchange, for instance, in South Asia between India and Pakistan with even 50 atomic bombs would create a condition in the stratosphere that would lower temperatures and contribute to perhaps a 20% failure of agricultural production. So these are they're interconnected. If you could conceive of an impact on climate, and as a reminder, beyond their immediate, powerful, devastating impact, that is also really deleterious effects for climate if there ever were a significant use of nuclear weapons again. As for civil society, more broadly, as you raised, Colin, I think there have been some successes. Some may follow the doomsday clock put out by the editors of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and that the handles of that clock were recently advanced to 100 seconds before midnight in light of concerns over the deteriorating situation between the leading nuclear powers. And we have with the Canadian Pugwash Group, I think, an important initiative that has its roots, indeed the home, or the cradle, if you will, of the international movement is in the charming, small Nova Scotia village of Pugwash, where back in 1957, the first meeting of nuclear scientists from both East and West were convened to try to encourage a dialogue despite the Cold War confrontation. And that's been kept up ever since, inspired by the 1955 Manifesto of Albert Einstein and Bertrand Russell, that already back then recognized that the power of the technology that humans were creating would mean that the next world war could well lead to the demise of humanity as a whole, and therefore had to be avoided at all costs. So I would urge listeners to take a look at Canadian Pugwash website. It's pugwashgroup.ca. if they want to be informed about what civil society activity could mean in this realm. And it's a very it's a small group, but it has some eminent Canadians as members, Douglas Roach, Setsuko Thurlow, John Polanyi, mentioned Peggy Mason, former ambassador for disarmament as well. Plus, we're actively looking out for younger members. There's an associate member category, which doesn't require any kind of lengthy CV or financial contribution, but allows those associate members to get on to our very lively listserv, which tries to keep information circulating about the approaches to nuclear arms control and the nuclear disarmament.
Well, good. I'm glad you said it, because we know that, not just anecdotally, but I sort of that a number of our listeners are millennials, and this is a good thing to join. My recollection was that a lot of the base group of the original Pugwash were scientists.
Yes, you're right. It was, of course, in some ways, recognition of the responsibility that those same nuclear physicists and technology experts that had contributed to the development of nuclear weapons, that they were conscious of the implications for security and global well-being going forward. And currently we take a very broad sense of the word scientists. Social scientists and activists are equally welcome as those who were engaged in the pure and applied sciences. But that is a reminder that individuals do have to take responsibility for the consequences of their work. And there's a powerful, of course, moral and ethical imperative that lies behind that and does continue to lead individuals to look to how they can make a contribution to trying to preserve global peace, you know, going forward.
Paul, I want to throw one at you which you would have dealt with during your career in arms control, and that was this: the whole issue of deterrence and NATO defense policy, and the fact that NATO defense policy has depended for a long time on nuclear weapons as a deterrent, partly when the Soviet Union had much greater conventional strength. Now we've got new tools in the game, cyber and disinformation, but can we afford to let nuclear deterrent go?
Well, I think we can with time. Obviously, it's something that would require prolonged and universal effort, but NATO does have as a proclaimed objective to achieve a world without nuclear weapons, and it has constantly said it supports the complete implementation of the NPT. It's true that currently it still has an official policy, a call for a mix of conventional and nuclear weapons. So there's a tension, to put it mildly, within those elements. But I think, again, it's up to its member states, including Canada and again some other like-minded states, to continue to look at reforming the alliance's nuclear policy, and for instance, to consider adopting an explicit Gulf first use stance, saying that those weapons were only there for deterrence against a nuclear attack. And indeed, it's become more complex, the world, with the advent of the cyber threat and indeed the vulnerability of nuclear reactors, but also nuclear weapon systems to possible cyber attack is most disconcerting. And I find it personally very sobering that the United States and its nuclear posture review, for instance, claims the right to respond to a major cyber attack against the United States with all means, including nuclear weapons. that, I think, is an irresponsible stance and then a potentially very escalatory ones. So we don't want to expand roles for nuclear weapons. We want to do the reverse. We want to systematically reduce and eventually lay the ground for their ultimate elimination.
You know, when I was a young officer, Pierre Trudeau had his peace initiative, of which a big piece of it was basically disarmament related. And I remember we had quite an effort. It was a prime ministerial driven. The department had a significant group that did it. Do we still have that same emphasis within our global affairs department on disarmament? Because certainly when you and I were junior officers, we had big bureau, there was a lot of effort attached to this. And certainly under Pierre Trudeau, his valedictory, in a sense, initiative was very much around this. Do you get the sense that we are as committed as we were?
I think, Colin, your observation is right on. There's been a diminishment of the perceived priority for work on disarmament within the foreign ministry. And indeed, there's been a diminishment in some of the human and financial resources allotted to this realm as a result. I think it would take a degree of a renewed political leadership plus support for rebuilding the capabilities within the foreign ministry to be more than a passive bystander on issues of nuclear governance worldwide. And as you noted in Pierre Trudeau's initiative, it was motivated as well, and this is something important to bear in mind, that if there ever was to be a nuclear weapon use, be it intentional or accidental, the effects are not going to be confined to the states possessing those nuclear weapons. It would impact all of humanity, and depending on the scale of that use, it could be just incredibly devastating. We don't need to renew the sort of hell that is so ably related by a witness to the Hiroshima bombing that we have in Setsuko Thurlow, who was recognized as part of the award of the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017 to the international NGO for the abolition of nuclear weapons. And so it behooves us all, I think, to work assiduously to try to reduce those risks in any way we can. And a country like Canada has, with its eminent non-proliferation credentials, and is very well placed, I think, to take up a role of leadership on these issues. And we look forward to that kind of activism going to be evident in the lead up to the NPT review conference.
Well, Paul, on that sobering note, but also a note of hope, let me first thank you for what you're doing for keeping this initiative going. I think it is an existential issue, as we are not always aware of, but critically important. And let me ask you, what are you reading these days?
Well, with the sort of enforced isolation with the pandemic, I guess one silver lining in that dark cloud is perhaps more time for reading. And I've taken up a volume that I had long been interested in tackling, and this is Tony Jute's Post-War, a magisterial account of the developments in Europe in the years after World War II. And he just shows an impressive erudition in this work. I'm only about a third of the way through, but it's a great effort. And unfortunately, he was an extremely talented historian whose life was tragically cut short He died at the age of 62 as a result of ALS, you know, Lou Gehrig's disease. But he's left us a great testament to his abilities as a historian in this work and some others.
Well, I heartily endorse having read into, and I can't say I've finished all, but I read into Postwar, and it really is superb, as are some of his other volumes. I'm busy. I've just finished a quartet by Evelyn Anthony. They're sort of spy thrillers set in the early 80s. And again, in this period, when you've got time to read, I find the diversions sometimes into fiction are a good idea. Well, thanks for listening to this episode of The Global Exchange. We were joined today by Paul Meyer. A link to Paul's paper, published by the International Journal, is on the CJAI website. I heartily recommend listeners pick it up. Remember, you can find the CJAI Network on iTunes, now Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give us a rating. You can also find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to producer Jay Rankin and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on The Global Exchange.